This episode is brought to you by Adobe. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for designing, sharing, and prototyping experiences. Try the free beta today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 42. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. Today, I got to interview the author of Practical Design Discovery, Dan Brown. I loved how Dan incorporated superhero analogies into some of his answers. It was so much fun and a real compliment to the format of the show. Also, listen in and find out why his superpower is X-ray vision, which is reflected in his superhero artwork. Also wanted to say, stay tuned till the end of the episode and you will find a 15% off of his book, Practical Design Discovery, from our great friends at A Book Apart. I want to take a second to share an iTunes review that came through recently. This one was from A Fifth Element. They said, awesome resource for UXers, 5 stars. Love listening to this podcast. I find myself resonating to a lot of the subjects and topics that Jason discusses. They validate most of my thoughts and how I do things. Keep up the great work, Jason, and keep defending our users through your voice and your guest voice. Thumbs up. Thanks so much for that review. I loved it, and I'm so glad to hear that the show and the subject matter is resonating with you and helping you to fight on. That's my goal, and so thanks so much for validating what I'm doing. Defenders listening, would you take a second to leave a rating and review on iTunes? It helps the show so much, and it doesn't take very long, but it makes a huge difference. You can do that by going to userdefenders.com/review. And guess what? I might even share it on a future episode. Thanks in advance. I really appreciate you. Dan Brown is a web designer who specializes in information architecture, design research, and leading teams. He's written 3 books, Practical Design Discovery, his latest, Designing Together, and Communicating Design. He created a card game, Surviving Design Projects, to help designers practice their conflict resolution skills. Dan also co-founded 8Shapes, a UX design firm based in Washington, D.C. in 2006 with his business partner, Nathan Curtis. Professionally, Dan likes talking about design discovery, information architecture, user research, and team dynamics. Now, personally, Dan likes talking about cooking and board games. And he also started an online support group for a rare disease he has. Dan, welcome to User Defenders. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, do you mind if I ask you about the rare disease? I know that's not something you talk about and probably not something you'd expect to be asked on a design podcast, but...
You know, I think, yeah, you can ask me anything you want. I actually have 2 rare diseases and I've written a little bit about them online. And I think it's, you know, everyone, you know, different strokes for different folks. I think it's important to me as part of my coping strategy for these rare diseases to be able to talk about them and educate other people about them. So, yeah. What kinds of questions do you have?
What is it?
Well, like I said, I have 2. Yeah. The one I started as a support group for is called Kallmann's syndrome, and it's a rare endocrine disorder. My body doesn't make any of its own hormones. Sex hormones, honestly.
Wow.
Even though I was born male, identify male, there's something wrong with the feedback mechanism in my endocrine system. So I'm on hormone replacement therapy, which allowed me to go through puberty and now live an essentially normal life.
Wow, Dan, I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, and I hope I'm not prying at all. I appreciate your transparency that you are an open book. You told me that, you know, nothing's off the table. So I appreciate you sharing that, Dan.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those diseases that's essentially not life-threatening at all. But it's somewhat insidious. You know, it strikes when you're a teenager, in a sense. I mean, you're born with it, but you sort of realize it when you're a teenager and you just don't go through puberty. And so it's insidious in that even though the treatment for it is relatively straightforward, it's often hard to diagnose, hard to kind of zero in on what it is exactly. and it's striking at your insecurities. So developing coping strategies around that, I think, is part of what's helped me become empathetic, right? You become a user defender, right? And sort of try and think about these things from other people's perspectives. That comes from, you know, experiencing a lack of empathy between people that I know, medical professionals who don't really understand the disease, don't really understand how it affects me as a person, and just learning to kind of interact with other people with this disease as well. I tell you, when I started that support group, it was life-changing, because when you have a rare disease, you think you're alone in the world. I mean, there's just as much support as you get from your parents and your family, or my wife has been incredibly supportive and understanding. You do think you're alone in the world. And I think everyone feels like that at some point. But when you start a support group, when you get that first email that says, "I have Kallmann syndrome too," it changes everything, right? It makes you think, you know what? I can make connections with other people.
Oh man, that's so good. And that's one of the things I love so much about this field, is it really is all about communication and connection.
Yep.
Right. And I'm sure you were able to use your design superpowers to make this community, this online group, and to help connect you with other folks and them to you. And that's so cool, man. Well, I'll tell you, the hormone, you know, I mean, you have an awesome voice, my friend. It's like manly and like, it's just like,
well, that's,
I love
that
slight rasp too. It's just an awesome radio voice.
That's the other rare disease that I have. I have a rare disease called recurrent respiratory papilloma. And all that means is I get polyps that spontaneously grow on my vocal cords.
Oh, wow.
And so they need to be removed once a year or so. And I've had this ever since I was 6 years old. So after dozens of surgeries now to have these things removed, there's scars on my vocal cords, and it just makes it sound like this, which is, you know, I guess a silver lining to all of that medical treatment.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, it's kind of like you're turning your kryptonite into a superpower, because, you know, I mean, and it's perfect for this theme of the show, because, you know, you are a superhero, man. And we're going to dive into more about why that is. But, you know, every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. And you've kind of touched on some really personal things already, and I appreciate that. It's a great start to this show, and it really, talk about empathy, it helps our defenders listening really just dive right into knowing, you know, where you're coming from. So I want to talk about yours, Dan. Can you tell us a story just about, maybe give us a look into your personal life, what you like to do when you're not working, perhaps?
Oh, sure. I mean, besides going and having throat surgeries every once in a while.
Oh, bless you.
I have a wife. My wife and I have been married for 20 years, and we have two children. And because of the Kallmann syndrome, there were, shall we say, obstacles to getting pregnant. And I'm not saying that other people don't appreciate their children the way I do, but they do have special meaning, a different kind of meaning for me, because I never thought I would ever have children. So I like spending a lot of time with them. I appreciate them. I love watching them become the people that they are becoming. We play a lot of board games, and I'm extremely lucky in that my two kids both share my love of gaming and board games and role-playing games and things like that. So in my spare time on the weekends, we always try and squeeze in one or two games. I also do a lot of cooking, which I really use to help me kind of disconnect from my work day, since I work from home, and is also a really interesting reminder about user research, because it turns out that my children are very critical of my cooking. I'm pretty good at it, but they are empowered to offer all kinds of opinions about it. And there's sort of an instantaneous feedback that you get, right? You cook the meal, you put it in front of them, and immediately you know whether it works or not. And sometimes we don't always get that luxury in the design world.
Well, tell us your origin story, Dan. What inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
Well, I don't know. You see, that when you talk to old guys like me, we just sort of found ourselves here more than anything else. So my origin story is, I don't know, maybe like the Fantastic Four, right? I kind of got into a ship, and I went into space, and then boop, I had powers. And I didn't, that was not the intention. But I guess every origin story is a bit of an accident.
Right.
Anyway, I majored in philosophy, and which meant that I was qualified for no careers whatsoever. But I'd always used computers when I was a kid. And what I didn't like about computers, what never occurred to me about computers, is that someone needed to design the stuff that was on the screen. And I think it never occurred to me because when I first had a computer, everything was command line, right? There wasn't, right. wasn't a lot of GUI. There wasn't any of that kind of stuff. And so it was only sort of, through the 80s and the 90s when we started to see GUI and graphical user interface emerge that, and then the web specifically in the 90s, it sort of hit me that you can design stuff that goes on the screen, not just the stuff that you end up printing out from a computer. I went to a conference called SIGGRAPH, which is like a huge computer graphics conference, thinking maybe I would be interested in that. And I really didn't click with me. But there I did learn about another field called CHI, Computer Human Interaction, CHI, sometimes HCI, Human Computer Interaction.
Right.
And I went to a conference for that field. I think that was my graduation present from my parents. And I loved it. I mean, I just felt like I'd come home. And again, that's, as you're a young adult, that's a rare feeling to have. Like, oh, this is where I belong. I ended up, that was 94-ish. So the web was really starting to emerge. And I started teaching myself HTML. And I got this job at a book publishing company where I did all things web. And again, finding myself not really qualified for any of them or especially good at any of them. But the one thing that I really enjoyed and that I was good at is thinking about the underlying structures, right? Thinking about what should the underlying experience be? What should the underlying architecture be? So when I moved to Washington, I got a job at an internet agency and decided to focus on information architecture there. From there, most of my work has been agency or consulting or contracting. And so I've worked on a bunch of different kinds of clients. Being in DC, I got to do some stints in the government. And then in 2006, Nathan approached me and said, we should start this thing. And by then, although I was fairly risk averse, I had had my first kid and I was quite keen to have more flexibility and more freedom to spend time with him. So starting 8Shapes really granted me an opportunity to grow my career in a new and different way, but also grant me some flexibility.
Yeah, I remember the early days of the web and honestly, it's funny. Our stories, Dan, are somewhat parallel. I remember the early days of the web and I was driving cars. I was a corporate lease driver at the time when I first experienced a chat room on America Online. And I couldn't believe that I could hold a conversation with somebody on the other side of the world in real time. And it was just, my mind was blown. I was like, wow, this is cool. And then I discovered personal publisher where I could make my own web page. And that was it for me. Like I actually made my own web page. I probably had about 20 animated GIFs on there, which was pretty awesome back then. And I just fell in love with the medium. So I appreciate that. But I think that that's kind of what I was getting at was just how much we kind of knew a little bit of everything at the time. Maybe we weren't incredibly awesome at everything, but you kind of had to know how to do a little bit of everything back then. And I think that was kind of what drove me to really just go full bore into this. And I'll be honest with you, like lately I've just been feeling a little bit of malaise. And I mean, I love what I do. I still work on the web, but I don't really get my hands dirty with like code as much. And I feel like that's probably what's been missing a little bit. And because that's what was, you just kind of reflect when you feel like you're, well, what's going on? What's going wrong here? You sort of reflect, well, what made me most joyful in this field? What made me the happiest and most fulfilled? And I think it was when I was actually designing something and then coding it myself and getting it into the browser. And I just feel like, that's what's been kind of missing a little bit. And so I've been a lot more intentional about trying to get back to that. And so I appreciate your origin story there, Dan.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that has happened on the web is that the tooling around it has become far more complex. And yes. I mean, it's sort of inevitable, right? It means it means one person can't know everything. I mean, I think about like 300 years ago, they say that one person could know all the knowledge that there was to know in the world because we were at the beginning of, you know, kind of science and, you know, thinking about and sort of understanding the world in that way. Mathematics wasn't as well developed as it is today. But now, because knowledge has exploded so much, no one person can know everything there is to know. And the same is true, I believe, for the web, right? Which is, there's lots of different techniques for tooling. There's lots of different mechanisms for creating the underlying architecture of the web. And so, yeah, one person could still probably build a website out of the box. But, you know, we need, because of the nature of the complexity of the thing, because it's tied into business, so specifically tied into business, we need more people. We need more expertise there. Have we lost something? Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's like you can't really work on a car in your garage anymore because all the cars are, you know, basically computers these days, you know, so it, in a sense, it's the same kind of thing. But at the same time, what have we gained, right? We've gained, you know, technology that has pervaded every aspect of our, for the most part, you know, for many people, every aspect of their livelihood and their need and supporting a variety of needs, which to me makes the work that we do, the contribution that we have to that sort of stack of complexity. It makes our contribution as designers even more important.
Wow, that is truly interesting, Dan, especially the part about automation. Everything is becoming automated. And I saw a Kickstarter project. I'm a coffee guy. I saw a Kickstarter project where it's an automated pour over. So it's like basically, it's like, don't we even want to like just get our hands a little dirty anymore? Like, I guess it's just, I'm kind of a, I don't know. I think I'm kind of a neo Luddite. I love technology so much, but I guess I start to get my eyebrows raised a little bit more and more whenever the human aspect is removed from, you know, from our technologies, I guess a little bit, just because I think that, you know, I think it's good to still be able to kind of, you know, do your own thing, be able to pour your own coffee. And, you know, like you said, if you can work on your, you know, change your own oil or whatever. So it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think we see this in design too, where we have an instinct as designers to try and provide as much support for users as we can. And by doing that, we end up trying to remove some of their own agency in a sense, right? Their own ability to control what they see. I'm working on a project right now for higher education. And, you know, we right now, I mean, it's an area where there's not a lot of good technological support for the work that they need to do, right? It's sort of this kind of open green field, if you will. And we're sort of like, just to mix my metaphors, kids in candy stores, right? We're like, well, we could do this and we could do this and we can do this. And what I like getting excited about the possibilities, but I also don't want to remove agency from the users. I don't want them to feel a lack of empowerment to control what it is that they see and do. A lot of times we want to put into the system, into the technology, the means for controlling a process or enforcing rules. And I'm not sure technology is great at that because rules change, things happen, right? Situations arise, and humans are really good at assessing what they need in order to address a new situation. So the technology should support that, right? Should give them opportunities to give them the data and the information they need to make better decisions. So this the idea of a pour over that's automated, you know, to me, I agree with you, right? There's why take that agency away from me? How does that help me? Obviously, if I'm a guy who's doing a pour over, which I do multiple times a day, I'm doing it because I like pouring it. I like pausing. I like watching, you know, the coffee go in. There's something about that ritual that is important to me, right? If I wanted it automated, I would just drink regular drip coffee.
Sure.
Wow. We covered a lot of ground there. that was impressive.
I like where this conversation is going. Yeah. And certainly we could probably spend the whole show talking about that, but I definitely want to get closer, get more into kind of, your journey as a designer and as a writer. And part of that, you know, is maybe cringeworthy as it can be, is talking about failure. I like to talk about it because I think it's great. You know, failure is learning, and certainly, especially in team environments. And I know that's been a big topic for you and a big area of research for you over the many years that you've been doing this, is teams. And certainly there's a lot of failure that can occur on teams as well. And so I just want to ask you, can you tell us a story about what's been maybe the biggest failure in your career?
Yeah, you shared that question with me, and I was struggling, and not because I don't fail, obviously, but because I can't point to a single project and say, well, that was a colossal failure. What I can do is look at almost every project I've ever done and say, well, there's about a million things I would have done differently on that project. Did we get to our goals? Yeah. Is the client happy? 9 times out of 10? Yeah. Is, you know, did the team feel fulfilled? For the most part, yeah. I know there are things that I would like to be able to do better as a designer and as a leader. So it's hard for me to point to a single kind of project that embodies, you know, failure from beginning to end. But we were talking about this. We just had our H-Apes retreat, and one of my colleagues shared a story about a team that he worked on, where there was one person on the team who really got under his skin, and it really resonated with me. And I shared with the team that about once a year, I'll work with a group of people or a team where there's one person there where I can't get past the personality. I can't get past the tone. I can't get past, you know, the superficial part of it, or even the content of what they're saying, to really engage in the project in a productive way. And when my colleague admitted this as well, it was, you know, there's a certain amount of relief, like, okay, you know, so we're all just human here. But at the same time, it makes me wonder, like, why does that happen? Could I sort of connect the dots between all the times that's happened and try to identify, you know, what all of those things have in common? Is there something about me that brings the worst out of these people? So for me, points of failure are times on the team where I can't even get to, did I manage the project well? Was the design good? I can't even get to that point because I have this kind of weird disconnect with one of the team members. Sometimes we can get past it, and sometimes we can gloss over it, and everyone has their own coping strategy for this. But for me, that sort of embodies what I think of as personal failure.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing that, Dan. And certainly working on a team, there's always going to be that dynamic or that struggle. Again, personalities clash, and maybe it's, you know, I wouldn't do it that way, or, you know, there's, so I'm glad that you took the time to really write this book and pour in your experience into this about, you know, why discovery is important and why being a good collaborator on a team is important too. So I want to get into that in a little bit, but I want to ask you, do you have a story, like, when some of your projects that you've done, like, of anything crazy or super awkward that may have happened during user testing?
Nothing really crazy. For the most part, I work on projects where the audiences are really specialized. So I lean on my clients to bring folks in. Like, for example, for the higher education, right? I can't just go out and recruit, you know, a dozen different deans from colleges. I need people to go out and do the legwork. And when we recruit those folks, it's because, you know, they have an interest in the project. But I did do some testing last year for a government agency. And of course, because they were a government agency, they were serving the general public. So we used an online service to do a recruit for us. And because of the nature of the testing, they, you know, it was remote testing, so they had to share their screens. And they would share their screen, and then we would direct them to the website or to the prototype, and they would walk through. And for the most part, it was fine. And even this was fine, but this one young woman came on and she shared her screen, and her desktop was a picture. There was sort of a picture in her desktop of like a scantily clad steampunk vixen type character. And it was very startling because it was unusual. And it was very, I appreciated the fact that she felt comfortable sharing this with total strangers. I don't know if this is a generational thing or what, but I mean, it's not my style to comment on those things. Mm-hmm. I'm sensitive to that's who she is. And I am glad that's who she is, but it was unexpected. That's how I'll put it. And she gave great interview. I mean, that was the thing. It was like, we got some great feedback from her. So I love that. I grew up in Greenwich Village in Manhattan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I grew up around a lot of people who didn't look or think like I do. And yet I still often find myself challenged by when people are, you know, break conventions. So.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, my sister and her family live in Greenwich. So that's funny that you mentioned that. Nice. Yeah. Love it. Yeah, we got to stay there for a week. A couple of years ago, my wife and I, we went, left the kids. It was incredible. Amazing. A lot of walking. In
yeah.
New York.
Well, that's maybe the only thing I miss about Manhattan is my family never owned a car.
Oh,
so yeah. I know a lot of teenagers think of cars as kind of liberating, but I always have thought of it as kind of this albatross, like, I got to pay insurance. I got to worry about it. I got to maintain it. Like all these things, which at the end of the day for a New Yorker is like, well, I'd rather just walk there. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. You really don't, you don't need a vehicle, especially out that way.
Right.
You just, Uber and taxi. Uber has really disrupted the taxi service, Uber and Lyft, which is a whole nother conversation.
Yeah. My parents are in their 70s and they are Uber fanatics. So. I'm trying to get them to use Lyft for a variety of reasons. And I think my mom actually downloaded the Lyft app, but yeah, I mean, this is being a New Yorker these days.
Yeah. So. It's interesting. Cause we took our cab ride from the airport and our driver was like, we had a conversation with him and we were talking about it. This was kind of before, you know, it really Uber and that whole thing really took off. But we were talking about it and he kind of made a comment. It was interesting because every single taxi cab in New York, it has to be officially licensed. And like every car has its own unique ID and it's totally done through the whole state. And he said, you know what one of these things is worth on the, you know, like the tag, the ID and the tag. He said,
the medallion.
Yeah, the medallion. Thank you. He said, these are worth over $1 million each, you know, or something like that. And I was like, oh my gosh. And you see every single yellow car you see. But I wonder what that is now, perhaps with the disruption.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Might have changed a little. Dan, what's your design superpower?
I really like peering beneath the surface and X-ray vision. Let's call it X-ray vision. And peering beneath the surface and kind of seeing the underlying structure of something. One of the reasons why I like discovery as part of the design process is I really feel like there's an opportunity for organizations to kind of bring to the surface the underlying structure, the underlying assumptions of the work that they do, the way they engage with their customers. And bringing that stuff to light allows us to critique it, allows us to tweak it, allows us to make sure that we're all on the same page with what that structure is. I'm working on a great project now, or let me say, it's a perfect project for me insofar as I work with an architectural licensing organization. They're kind of like an industry organization that facilitates architectural licensing. And there's a bunch of rules that govern how you can become an architect in different states. And because of how this organization is positioned, it needs to have a common understanding of those rules, even though all those rules came from different states, right? They kind of emerged from individual state processes. So trying to find some commonality across all of these different mechanisms for becoming an architect is something that grew organically in this organization, but now they're realizing that to facilitate speed and other benefits to burgeoning architects, they need a common language, a way of referring to these rules in a common way. So this is it, right? Looking beneath the surface, identifying what's there and trying to see structures that maybe people haven't seen before, and also build structures that can support this range of, what do you want to call it, content, right? That until now has lived in very disparate places.
Yeah, I love that X-ray vision. That makes so much sense. And I know that a lot of organizations, they sort of have tunnel vision, right? I mean, they're looking at the same thing every day with the same set of eyes. And so it makes a lot of sense that you're able to come in as an outsider and right. really do your research and really dig deep into learning everything about this organization, their culture. And I mean, and I love how you mentioned that in the book too. It's like, it's even important to know the culture of the business when you're doing design discovery. So great, great stuff in the book, Defenders. Conversely, Dan, what's your design kryptonite?
Well, I mean, like a lot of superheroes, I feel like my greatest strength is my greatest weakness. And I feel like it's easy for me to get stuck on that stuff because it's a happy place for me. It's a safe place for me.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if you're Thor, you want to hit everything with your hammer, right? And sometimes, you know, you just... There's just not a time and a place to use a hammer, right?
When you're a hammer, everything's a nail.
Right, right. And when you're, you know, Mjolnir, everything looks like a troll, you know? So that was a deep cut. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, man. Love it.
So digging deep into these rules for this particular organization is my happy place, and they are giving me a long leash to do it. And I'm grateful for that. But we don't have that on every project, right?
Yeah.
And so part of me needs to be the Steve Rogers or the Clark Kent, right? Who needs to kind of work with other people, not in a X-ray vision kind of way, right? Not using the superpowers, but are we progressing towards our goals? Are we getting towards the objectives that we set out for this project? Are we getting to something that's feasible, that's buildable, that we know that users want? I was a philosophy major. I love thinking deeply about things, but that's not a great way of building a website, right? That's one part of it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm in a constant, I was going to say this, constant battle with myself to sort of, on the one hand, let out, employ as much of that power as I can, but also not be irresponsible about it, not let it go so long just because it makes me feel good, just because I'm good at it, just because we're learning interesting things, but also bringing that back in and making sure that it's meaningfully contributing to the goals of the project.
I'm tickled by the superhero analogies, Dan. You're the perfect guest for this format. I love it. You're indulging and bringing value to the superhero theme. So I appreciate that.
Sure, Jason. When you reached out to me, I was so excited because nothing would make me happier than to talk about design in the context of superheroes.
Oh,
so,
perfect.
Yeah.
This is great. So speaking of that, this is a fun one. And I always caveat this question ever since episode 6, when Chloe kind of called me out on it about it, you know, I can't be a superhero without my team. And you're definitely a guy that would admit that too, because you've got a great team surrounding you, Dan. And I know that you always... and in the things that I've researched about you, you always mention your partner, Nathan, and just how you guys are kind of like a superhero force together. And so I want to ask you, what would your UX superhero name be?
I'm not going to lie. I've given this a lot of thought. And I freely admit that makes me a giant nerd. I think part of the problem with this question, I like the hey, we're not, you know, we're a team, right? And yeah. We're like Voltron, right? All of the lines need to come together for us to be really powerful. I'm probably not the first person to say that on this podcast.
No, you are. And that's a great one.
I'm the first person.
You were the first, Dan. Ding, 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 ding. You just won something.
It's because I'm probably the oldest person you've had on this podcast.
No. You just won an automated pour over machine.
only if it breaks apart into different lines. But I feel like you can look at your superpower, right? I can look deeply at a problem, see the underlying structures, but you apply that in lots of different ways, right? And so that's useful to me in discovery, right? When we're trying to first learn about a client, it's useful to me when we're trying to, figure out what the navigation is or what the content strategy is or what the overall structure of the website should be. You know, what is the list of templates that we'll need? So when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, well, that the problem is that I use these powers in lots of different ways, right? And so I could sort of embody this in, just the power, but it's also in the application of the power. So I did what I always do when I have a difficult question like this in front of me, and I turn to one of the two people in my life who, I always get sort of sound advice from, and that's either Nathan, my business partner, or Sarah, my wife. And she did not even pause when I asked her this question. She said, "It's Dr. Discovery." And I was that is really good. So you can see why I love her.
Oh man. Yes. Yes. You found the right one, my friend.
Yes.
That's awesome. I love that. Dr. Discovery. That's perfect.
Okay, good.
Yes. So one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." Here's more nerdery for you. Mm. How do you fight for your users, Dan?
You know, I love this question. And I feel like there's lots of ways we can talk about this, right? Sort of cultivating an understanding of, what their needs are, seeing past what they report their needs to be and look at what their actual needs are, try and work towards their goals, try and balance out their needs with, or try and create a counterbalance between what the business is asking for, how they need to make money, with where users fit in to that process. Advocating for them, I feel like you've probably gotten tons of great answers to this question. I feel like there is probably an opportunity for us to be thinking in terms of how do we challenge them? And, I don't want to get rid of their agency. We talked about that earlier.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we talk a lot about simplification and streamlining, and keeping them focused. I'm not advocating for going back to, very complex Windows interfaces or, green screen interface. That's not what this is about. But this is maybe giving them more credit for being able to think about what's in front of them and giving them more credit for parsing complexity. That in order for them to feel empowered, in order for them to feel like they own their information, we need to show it to them. And though a lot of modern web design is really about kind of streamlining, simplifying, pulling things out, flattening, I think there's something to be said for giving them a little bit of credit to say, you know what, I can put this in front of them, and I'm confident that even if they don't understand it immediately, that they will. If it's important to them, they will figure it out.
Ah, that's fascinating, Dan. I couldn't help but think about Steve Jobs and, when you talked about giving the user the credit, isn't it funny how when you're in a research environment, like you're doing a contextual inquiry, for example, watching the person use the software, use the web design that you made, isn't it funny how if they can't really figure it out right away, they kind of blame themselves?
Yeah.
Isn't that, yes. I mean, it's funny and it's sad because it's, Steve Jobs said, if the user has a problem, it's our problem.
Right.
It's not their problem.
Right.
We didn't design it well. We didn't research enough. Right.
Right.
You want to speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point. I feel like I'm actually seeing less and less of that these days. And I don't know if it's just because as generations have moved on, the current cohort of grownups, grew up with this technology and understand that it's not on them entirely.
Yeah, that's true.
But, so I feel like there's greater sophistication there.
That's a good point.
But I do feel like because of that, we can challenge them some more. And this doesn't eliminate the need to make things clear. It doesn't eliminate the need to make things direct. It doesn't eliminate the need to make things well designed. It just means we don't have to treat them in a way that disempowers them in any way.
do you remember those Hair Club for Men commercials where the hirsute challenged guy says, "I'm not only the president, I'm a client"? Well, when it comes to Adobe XD, I'm not only the proud sponsor, I'm a user. I've been using XD for an important product at work, and I've been blown away by this tool. There's a saying in UX that I like a lot, it's show, don't tell. Another is that a prototype is worth a thousand meetings. Adobe XD gives you the power to truly show your leadership, stakeholders, analysts, and clients exactly what you're thinking. Not only show, but even interact with. And it's super simple to use. Adobe keeps adding new features and improving this product all the time. XD is being used by enterprise-level companies for important design projects, and get this, it's only in beta. Unbelievable. I can't recommend enough that you kick the tires and see how XD helps turn you into a design and prototyping superhero. Try the free beta for Mac or Windows today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more.
All right. Well, hey, Dan, let's wrap up the show with the imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
That's a really good question. Drinking pour overs, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think never settling. And one of the things that I love doing is coming up with a design or coming up with a structure or an information architecture and then saying, what if I were to do this completely differently? And that does a couple things for me, right? It exposes some new ideas. It lets me look at the problem in a new way, right? So on the one hand, I can sort of say, let me turn this inside out and see, does structuring the thing completely differently give me any new solutions? And even if it doesn't, maybe just by doing that, I'm seeing the problem in a new way. So by never sort of settling on this is the right way to do it, I can always ask myself, well, what's another way that I can approach this? I use this in sketching sessions all the time, where when we hold a brainstorming session with our clients, you know, we'll give them 10, 15 minutes to sketch out the first idea that comes to them. But often we try and sketch out two or three or four ideas of different ways to approach it. And I challenge myself in that time to just put the first thing I think of down on paper. Okay, I've done that. I've got that out of my system. Now, what if I were to do it completely differently? Or what if I were to take this little part and make that the focus of the UI? And now I can put a range of options in front of the client and challenge them as well, right? Get them to see the problem in a new way.
Yeah, that's so good.
Never settling.
Never settling. Defenders never settle. And I talk to my buddies when I'm talking to you. It's like, you know, this is a conversation that it's amazing to be able to share, and people are actually listening to this. So I like to talk to the defenders and encourage them, you know, especially when there's a great takeaway like that. I mean, never settle. And the amazing thing about this field is that we don't have to ever settle. And really, right. Design is never done. A design is never done. And the beauty of it is we can actually put something out there, and that's when we really start learning, and then we can make it better.
Right.
Amazing.
Exactly.
Not settle. Always be iterating. That's great.
Right.
So, Dan, what's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
Oh, wow. Sometimes I wish I had Thor's hammer.
Did you see that new movie, the new movie coming out where she grabs the hammer and crushes it? She must be pretty powerful.
No.
Oh, goodness. Ragnarok. Ragnarok.
Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. Check out the trailer.
That's the one where Hulk shows up and Thor's really excited that one of his coworkers showed up.
We worked together.
Yeah, my son and I loved that trailer.
Sorry.
So the question was in a most important tool.
Yeah, like an invincible resource or tool.
I mean, you have to understand. So when I started in the 90s, there were no tools. And then we discovered, you know, everyone was using Photoshop because that existed back then.
Mm-hmm.
Then we discovered Visio, which was a diagramming
tool,
which kind of helped us create some diagrams to explain architecture. And then Visio fell out of favor and I switched to a Mac. And so we started using InDesign. And then we started prototyping in HTML. And, you know, then we started using Omnigraphle for our diagrams. And then, you know, it's just been this endless parade of tools. of digital tools, I should say. And I feel like that's going to continue and for as long as we're around. I love, so just to be clear, I use Sketch and InVision as my primary tools. I do a lot of diagramming and creating posters in Omnigraffle. But I think the most powerful tool that we have is the question. Mm. And maybe you've heard that before from some of your other guests, but you know, it's the one that I can always turn to. I can always use question whenever something is unclear or whenever something has some baked in assumptions that I want to unpack, or when people show up with preconceived ideas, I can always turn to the question to help keep the design process moving forward. At our offsite, just in the last couple of days, we had someone come in to help us learn about coaching. As consultants, we're experts, right? We come in and we ask a lot of questions, but we're asking questions about the product, about how the organization works, but we don't ask a lot of questions about the people who are working on it. And this coaching coach, I guess, really helped us see questions in a new way. And I bring that up only to say that, you might think, okay, questions, everyone can ask questions, or I'm an expert user interviewer, so I'm really good at asking questions. And this person was coaching us in how to ask questions in a way that made us uncomfortable, right? That made us look at questions in a new way. And these are people with, you know, combined probably close to 100 years of experience, right, at this table. And here we were sort of being pushed into new territory. So even the lowly question is ripe for constant. You can constantly improve how you do that.
Oh, that's really cool, Dan. The question is a great invincible resource. And I love that because that's the only way we can really learn is by asking questions, right? And I think the precursor to asking questions is that spirit of curiosity, which is a requirement for any designer in this field. You have to be curious, right? About the people you're designing for. And you have to have empathy for them in their situations and try to understand as best you can the context of how they're using this tool and things and how it improves their lives. And
in my second book, which was called Designing Together, that's where I talk a lot about teamwork and dealing with conflict and cultivating collaboration. And I spend a lot of time talking about mindset, which is not just attitude, but it's a way that we look at the world. And I feel like the things that you're talking about in terms of curiosity, I don't get at those so much in that book, but it occurred to me that while collaboration requires one type of mindset, creativity requires another kind of mindset. And that's in part curiosity, there's skepticism in there, and there's humility in there as well, right? And so all of these things combine to help us be our most creative selves. And sometimes it's hard for us to be humble, and sometimes it's hard for us to be curious and get excited about new things, especially when you're talking about, I don't know, you know, dental insurance. I worked on a dental insurance product, and it's like that. You could not take two more boring topics and put them together, but here we were. And skepticism, right? Sometimes you're just so focused on getting to your goal that you forget to be skeptical, right? To sort of question everything because you just want to get to the finish line, right? It's easy to push those things aside. But in order to be our most creative selves, we really need to embrace those mindsets. And we do that through behaviors, right? By cultivating certain behaviors, like how do I ask a better question? Or how do I never settle, right? How do I never look at this as done, right? All of those things help our surface level behaviors that help us cultivate those mindsets.
Yeah. And this is good for me too, Dan, because if I listen, and I do occasionally when I need a dose of humility, I listen to episode one when I, the first time I ever, you know, hit record on this thing, so humbling. But I see the trajectory. I feel like I'm getting better. I'm always learning, always growing. I definitely have a growth mindset. So this is good for me. And I want to continue to learn how to ask good questions, how to ask great questions and try to extract value for listeners. So that's good for me too. I appreciate that.
There's a book that I just picked up and I only just started reading, but I've already underlined a bunch of stuff, and it's called A More Beautiful Question. And I, one of the reasons why the title resonated with me is that Nathan's favorite poet, I think it's his favorite poet, certainly a poet that he talks a lot about, is E.E. Cummings. And that title of the book is taken from an E.E. Cummings poem.
Oh, wow.
So A More Beautiful Question. And the author, I don't remember the author's name, but he wrote a whole book on, I think it was innovation and creativity and sort of looking at people and what, looking at successful creative people and where do they get their ideas. And in doing the research for that book, he realized that one of the things that they all have in common is that they're good at asking questions. So he then wrote this book, A More Beautiful Question, about that practice as well. So that's what's on my nightstand underneath a lot of comic books, but it's there.
I'm getting it. I'm getting that book. Cool. Now, I don't know if this is a spoiler alert for the next question. I have an assumption of what your answer might be based on a talk you did. It's called Stop Fighting, Start Designing, which was great, by the way. But you mentioned, I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to see what you answer. And I might've just biased you. If you could recommend, and by the way, I'm going to caveat this question too. In addition to Practical Design Discovery, which Defenders, I highly recommend picking up. And our friends at A Book Apart have been kind enough to offer a discount code, 15% off. I'll mention it at the end of the show and also look for it in the show notes. In addition to that, which I'm going to recommend, if you could recommend one book to our listeners, and you just did, if you could recommend a different book, what would it be and why?
I really push designers to read books that are just slightly outside the design field, right? There are tons and tons of technical books out there, and there are a lot of great ones. I mean, I think the book that you should read is the book about some topic that interests you, whether that's history or psychology or sociology or any of those things. For me, a book that I read a couple of years ago in preparing for a Practical Design Discovery, I read a bunch of books about creativity. And one of the ones that I read is called Powers of Two, and by Joshua Wolfe, I think his name is. And Powers of Two is a book about creative couples or creative partnerships.
Wow.
And he makes this argument that creativity doesn't happen in a single person's brain, that in fact, it's two people, or at least two people, where some of our best, most creative work comes from. The canonical example, or the archetypical example, is, of course, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, right? That they had this kind of intense relationship verging on, you know, sort of the drama of a romantic relationship that drew some of their best work out of each other. They were, on the one hand, competitive, but on the other hand, supportive of each other. And I really feel like there's something to be said for those kinds of relationships. It's a different take on creativity, and that's why it was useful and interesting for me to read.
So. Awesome. No, this is great. I'm going to put links to these books in the show notes as well, Defenders. And I have an Amazon affiliate too, by the way. So if you buy it through my link, you'll be helping User Defenders at no additional cost. So they finally let Coloradans into the affiliate program. They didn't do that for a while because of some tax issue here. I don't know. But anyway, those are great. And I do want to talk about your book, Dan. I want to take a few moments here to talk about Practical Design Discovery. What is it and why is that important? What inspired you to write it?
I have this ridiculous habit of trying to unpack complicated parts of the design practice. So my first book was on documentation and my second book was on collaboration. And now this is on discovery, which is, you know, that kind of messy, almost chaotic first part of the design process we often associate with the first part of the design process, where we're trying to get our arms around the design problem. But by doing that, we're also trying to establish a design direction or creative direction for the project. So Practical Design Discovery is really a bird's eye view of the processes that I use to help me understand the problem and set a direction. And those two halves of discovery are really important historically, people have often thought of discovery as, you know, gathering the requirements or just doing the research. But I think it's one of the things I learned about creativity is that you can't really understand a problem until you try and solve the problem. And so that's why there are these two halves to it. The other way that we can cut it up is sort of broad thinking and convergent thinking, or divergent and convergent thinking. And a lot of people have sort of treated that aspect of design. But I wanted to elaborate on that model so that we're thinking not just in terms of what the solution is, how we come to understand the problem and the relationship between understanding the problem and conceiving of a solution. So practical design discovery is really divided into five chapters. The first is just an overview of what discovery is. Chapters 2 and 3 are really about those two halves, right? So what do we mean when we say trying to understand a problem? What do we mean when we say we're trying to set a direction for a solution? And then chapters 4 and 5 deal with more nuts and bolts aspects of discovery. So one of those is the processes, right? What does a schedule look like? What does a plan for discovery look like? And then the last chapter is really, how do we take everything that we've learned and package that up into documentation? The hard part about writing a book like this is there are lots of different software engineering methodologies these days. There's lots of design processes these days. So the entire book rests on a framework that is meant to be agnostic. It's meant to sort of say, I don't care whether you're waterfall or Scrum. I don't care if you do big documents at the end or informal documentation throughout. Like, it doesn't matter to me what methodology you use. What matters to me is that you've got a vocabulary and a way of thinking about the discovery process, so that you can then apply that to whatever framework that you're using.
Yeah. And team collaboration is a big part of this too, of this process and of what you outline in the book. And I know, like, just from experience in my past, but also I've heard other stories too, just there's that tension sometimes between designers and developers and maybe just not being on the same page. And you kind of touch a little bit on it in your talk. I mentioned about, you know, for example, there's a designer's point of view and like a prototyper or developer's point of view. And sometimes they're at odds. And so that can build tension. It can kind of hold up the success of a project sometimes and maybe even, and unfortunately too, on the side of the client, their expectations are not managed well because of that possible tension or dissension, whatever, in the team. What are some of the biggest obstacles you've seen like that, and what are some of the kind of the solutions, like without giving everything away, but like, what are some ideas, you know, because we got to buy the book, Defenders.
I have 2 kids I need to send to college. So not that selling books helps pay for college at all. I mean, it's a big question,
can't
right?
We all
and
get
it's
along?
Sort of the, yeah, I mean, it's, I think, look, and if you were to ask me this tomorrow or yesterday, I would have completely different answers, right? Just that's the nature of kind of how we work, right? Different things are top of mind for us. For me, what's top of mind at the moment is culture, right? Which is a word that a lot of people throw around. In this case, I mean, sort of the habits of how people work together. I work with organizations that have historically not collaborated, right? They've sort of maintained those very clear silos between them, and attempts to traverse those silos, to at least peek through the silos, are discouraged. And at the individual level, this comes down, or I guess at the executive level, there's a certain amount of possessiveness, right? This sort of, if you have the knowledge, then you're more powerful. And at the individual level, there's what my friend Erica called status anxiety, right? This idea of, how do I look in the organization? What, you know, how does this make, prop me up? How does this make me look to my boss?
Mm.
And we see this in a lot of, not just large bureaucracies, right? Mm. Even startups these days have these problems of rewarding the wrong behaviors. So I think that the biggest obstacles to collaboration are the simple excuse of, well, this is the way we've always done it.
Oh, I hate which, that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, that's not my organization, or that, you know, we never make that excuse. But I don't know, I guess I would challenge people out there to sort of really think about, well, why did you do something this way the last time you did it? Or when you look at your project plan, why did you make those choices? Are they based on experience? Are they based on a desire to experiment? Or are they literally a regurgitation of your previous project plan? You know, what is it that's driving your method and your approach? Believe me, I acknowledge that I am the worst, one of the worst project managers in the world. Hey, I acknowledge that this is something that I need to work on. But at the same time, I like being deliberate about, okay, what are we doing this week and why are we doing it?
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned if kind of the whole, we've always done it this way. And obviously that's a big roadblock to innovation. I'm really glad that there's a lot of companies and, you know, a lot of startups, let's be honest, that haven't adopted that point of view, because we wouldn't be where we are if we just settled on, we've always done it that way. That's why we're not changing. It's safer that way. You know, Seth Godin said it's safer to be risky, right? Especially in this world. So I appreciate that. I always say, if it ain't broke, break it and make it better.
Right.
And we need to do more of that as designers, especially. And that's what we love to do. And we love to solve problems and make things better. And I had a conversation with Matt Griffin recently, and it was kind of funny, and it's probably the title of his episode, but everything sucks and it's great. Everything's terrible and that's great for designers. But I want to say, I think part of the problem too is the lack of trust. And again, that does kind of stem from culture. And I want to tell a quick story too about kind of just something that I personally encountered. I had some challenges with a developer at my organization, and we bumped heads a little bit. And it was kind of that, you know, sort of ownership thing, who owns what and, you know, roles and responsibilities, which I know you talk a lot about as well, in the book. And so what I did was I invited the guy out to coffee. I paid for it, you know, make sure you pay for it. But yep. We invited him to coffee. There's one right down the street. And so we took a nice stroll. It was beautiful outside. Took a stroll together to the coffee house and we talked, and it wasn't about business until toward the end. It was personal. We talked about, I wanted to get to know him, and I genuinely did. It wasn't like I'm trying to buy your favor. It was like, no, I genuinely wanted to get to know him more. And I didn't realize, but I was building trust at the time that I was doing this. And I'll tell you, I kid you not, Dan, ever since then, everything's been different. Like there's like a camaraderie. There's like this kind of invisible sort of trust and camaraderie now between this guy, and a lot more collaboration has happened as a result. I recommend it.
Yeah, that's great. Do you have a sense of what was it that was motivating you to genuinely want to get to know the guy? Because I can see, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, right? I can also see this person completely rubs me the wrong way. Mm. I don't want to have anything to do with them. I'll have a meeting if I need to, but other than that, I don't want them in my life. They bring out the worst in me.
Yeah.
So where do you think that motivation came from?
Yeah. Well, I think it was just kind of taking myself out of it, getting out of my own head, which has been, the podcast has really helped me a lot. I still struggle with it, but the podcast has helped me to get out of my own head a lot. But it's really kind of just going, this is another human being who has similar, if not probably different struggles as me. And I just want to get to know this guy more. I feel like it's only going to help. I feel like, you know, getting into his world a little more. We talked about family. I got to know more about his family and, you know, kind of where he's from and what they're doing. They're taking a trip back there, you know, shortly after our coffee. And so it was really neat. You know, I've got to talk about kids and I don't know. I think it was just, one of the things is emotional intelligence. And that's kind of I'm sure you've studied a lot about that too, Dan, in leadership and, you know, studying leadership. I think it's growing in emotional intelligence too. And just being willing to overlook somebody's faults, to try to realize that they're humans too. And they're struggling through this life as well, just like you are. And how much better could things be to be able to just connect and to overlook faults. We all have faults. We all have issues. And I'm sure that, like you said, you touched on earlier, it's like, you know, I'm having so much struggle with this person. Is it me? Maybe it's me.
Right. There was something you said that I really liked. And I think that's, it's important to acknowledge this, that for the most part, 99% of the time, even if you feel like you're struggling with someone, they have the best interests of the project at heart too. So yes, even if you don't agree with what they're doing or how they're doing it, they believe that they are, everyone believes they're doing the right thing. They have, and they have good motives, right? And I feel like, to your point about emotional intelligence, understanding, admitting that, and then trying to understand how is it that they're trying to make a contribution,
yes,
helps you, and I love how you put this, get out of your own head, right? It helps you sort of get past this sort of superficial, they've gotten under my skin, I can't even listen to them anymore, right? But as soon as you start to say, clearly they want to, they're working towards the same thing I am, but you know, what is it about their perspective, or what is their perspective on achieving those goals?
Thanks, Dan. I totally agree with you. And I love what you said too about like just look at the contributions that they're making. Like, they care as much about the project as you do. And I like that, because I think that's something that gets forgotten when we kind of start to try to own everything and not, and kind of lose that spirit of collaboration. It's like, no, this person cares too. And maybe that's where a lot of the tension comes from, is that, yeah, you both care about the project. Yay. Right? Like, yes, that's a good thing. Let's go all in on that quality, on that characteristic. But I also want to share, like, it's so funny because I'm just started reading a book by Jin Sincero. It's called You Are a Badass. Okay.
Nice.
And it's good. Like, she does not mince words. Like, and this is a quote. I just wrote this down. I'm not kidding. I think it was yesterday. And it's about people. And this is so good, Dan. And this is great. It's, release all expectations. Let everyone off the hook. Treat people as a blank slate over and over again. Expect only the best from them, regardless of what they've done in the past, and you may be surprised. What you focus on, you create more of. And if you keep expecting people to annoy you, they will not let you down. Focus on their finer points and encourage their good behavior if you want to create more of it. Right?
I like the second half of that a lot.
Yeah.
I guess you know, when you get to a point in your career, a lot of people look to you to provide mentoring or leadership or counseling. And so I often feel like part of my role is not to treat someone as a blank slate, right? To help them draw on their experiences, right? Okay. To not discount the things that I don't think this is the point that author was making, but I worry about, and this is, I'm also a person in the third decade of my career where I'm sort of thinking about, part of the value that I bring to the table is I've done this a lot, right? And I've faced a lot of different situations. Right. And I don't want younger folks to discount that experience, right? I don't, my experience or their experience, right? I don't want them to say that just because now I'm in my mid-30s as opposed to my late 20s, I have less to offer because whatever, I'm less creative or less dynamic or I'm slower. What, you know, I can't learn the technologies as fast. There is tremendous value to the fact that your slate is mostly filled up, right? You can draw on that stuff, and that's useful. I think using that against someone, yeah, that's you know, that's not something you want to do. Yeah. But allowing someone to kind of reflect on their own slate and understand what's there and how it got there, I don't think we see enough of that in the world in general, but also in our business.
Pick up the book, Defenders, Practical Design Discovery. I'll be sure to link to it in the show notes. And again, there'll be a discount thanks to our great friends at A Book Apart.
Hello, this is Josh Clark. I'm the author of Designing for Touch. And friends, this is User Defenders, defending the user against noxious user experiences. Go get them.
Dan, this is my last question for you. And it's one of my favorites because I know that there's a lot of aspiring designers listening. They're really trying to navigate and find their way. That's why I do this, to try to offer some guidance, maybe a light on the pathway. And you have certainly done a lot to that end today, and I appreciate it. What's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes?
Oh boy.
You've given a lot already. I'll give you that.
Yeah. I wrote this Medium post that I hope you link to as well. It's called Do As I Say, Not As I Do, which is sort of my parenting philosophy, which is really not good. Fortunately, my children have their mother as well. Yeah, so they should just do everything she does and everything will be fine. Anyway, in Do As I Say, Not As I Do, I give 8 pieces of advice to...
Eight pieces?
Eight pieces.
Oh.
Pieces.
Sorry,
starting giddy. Eight slices of advice to aspiring UX designers.
Nice.
So it's hard to zero in on just one, but I don't know. I'm trying to think of something new that I didn't say in that article.
Well, it's okay. You can touch on something your greatest takeaway of the article as well, and then we'll link to it, and they'll read the rest. It's up to you.
It'll all be good. Well, I feel like I want to go back to something I said earlier, which is the invincible tool, the Mjolnir of user experience design is the question, and I think get great at asking questions. Right? I think if we're talking about advice. In terms of, you know, what's one thing that you can cultivate and start to cultivate today? I don't care what your role is. I don't care even if you're not a researcher, even if you conceive of yourself as a person who just sits in a corner and makes mock-ups all day long, right? Get great at asking questions. Sometimes that means making little prompts for yourself so you know not to ask yes, no questions, but instead ask more qualitative questions. Sometimes it means preparing a list of questions before you walk in to a meeting. Sometimes it means, as I often do, sort of think about what are the questions that I would want someone to ask me. The question, and my friend Erica, again, in a talk at the O'Reilly Design Conference 2 years ago, said this exact thing, that the question is the most powerful tool that we have. But it's not something that's static, right? It's something that we can always be thinking about how to make that better. Taking 15 minutes out of your day to prep for a meeting, to think of the good questions, I think that's time very, very well spent.
Oh, so good, Dan. Couldn't agree more. The question. So, Dan, as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
I tweet a lot of politics these days. So if that's not your bag, then, you know, you don't have to follow me on Twitter. I'm Brownorama on Twitter. Also Brownorama on Medium. I write articles on Medium. A lot of practical stuff these days on different discovery techniques as kind of a supplement for the book, Practical Design Discovery. I didn't dig into different discovery techniques in detail in the book because it is this 10,000 foot view. But I have been writing short pieces on different techniques that I use there. And if you like board games, I'm on Instagram also as Brownorama, and it's largely pictures of my kids and I playing different board games. So
that's interesting. That's different. Well, at least it's not your food.
I occasionally, because I'm a cook, I occasionally post, like if I'm particularly proud of something that I've cooked, I post a picture of it before the kids critique it, because then I'll just feel bad about it. But I also have a dog, so for some reason, a lot of dog pictures.
Nice. I'm kidding around, but it's, you know, slightly, I'm sort of kidding. No.
Yeah, sure. I'll post a picture of my pour over for you.
Yes, please do. Yeah. Please do. Right on. And by the way, you know, real quick, I just was thinking about we were talking about books, and I kind of said that I think I know what you were going to say. And I never really kind of spoke to that. And I thought you were going to say mindset, because you mentioned that book in your talk. And I'll tell you, that book, that was such a great read too. And it really, that was probably been one of my more impactful, like, personal growth books that I've read this year. And I think ever, to be quite honest. Yeah. I know you touch on mindset too, and in your book and in your work, which is just an important thing. So that's what if one of the defenders, if you were listening, you're like, why didn't he say what he was going to say? That's what I was going to say. Okay. But anyway, mindset.
I recommend mindset almost every time, but I'm mixing things up a little bit.
No, I love it.
Keeping your listeners on their toes.
No, I love it. And I feel like this is like just total exclusive, man, because I just feel like you shared so much that I haven't heard you share elsewhere. So I just really appreciate you, Dan.
Sure.
Thank you for all you do for our field. Dude, you are fighting on, and I appreciate that. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Thank you very much for all of those kind words. It means a lot to me, and I will continue the good fight.
Can't you just hear the decades of experience come through Dan's voice and how he articulates what he does? And just love talking to Dan. Such a rich conversation. If we're not discovering everything we can about the project, we end up designing the wrong thing. And also the question, the invincible resource, that is so great. Just the question, because really, aren't we doing this work for other people? We're doing this work for the business and the users. So it's so good to be inquisitive and to let curiosity be a superpower as well. I want to plug Dan's book because it is so good. And also our great friends at A Book Apart have offered an exclusive Defenders discount of 15% off Dan's book, Practical Design Discovery. And the way you do that is I will put a link in the show notes. And once you get over there, use the coupon code DISCOVER to get 15% off Dan's great book. It is awesome. So I wanted to share that with you. And also there's 3 months. They gave us 3 months to use this code. It expires December 18th of this year. So don't delay. Also wanted to share with you, Defenders, there's some really exciting stuff happening. I am finally redesigning the website. And when I say redesign, I'm basically using a different theme, but doing a ton of CSS work to try to get it to look right. But anyway, the exciting thing about this is that there's going to be an online store. So that is huge news. You've probably seen me wearing a User Defender shirt, and I've had a number of you ask me, how can I get one of those? Well, the great news is you will be able to very soon here. So stay tuned. You can get on the Biweekly Bugle to kind of hear about progress there at userdefenders.com/join. But I'm so excited. I just wanted to share that with you. I did share it with my subscribers first on the Biweekly Bugle, but you are the next to hear about it. I can't wait to open that shop, open up shop there. Oh, in 2 weeks, I can't wait to share with you my deep dive interview with the matriarch, certainly one of the matriarchs, if not the, of our industry, the one and only Laura Klein. Such a great interview. We really veered off the normal format and just, it was so organic and talked about some interesting stuff about design. So anyway, look forward to that. Oh, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss it. You can do that by going to userdefenders.com/subscribe. Thanks so much for listening, Defenders. I know there's a ton out there, a lot of content, and I just appreciate you coming back to this one time and again, and also the encouragements through iTunes and such. And so please let me know if there's ever anything I can do for you. I just really appreciate you. I want you to know that. So until next time, fight on, my friends.